There are dire warnings that New South Wales will be hit by increasingly extreme weather.
2015 was the hottest year since climate records began.
Your show this July was the single hottest month in recorded history.
Australia sweltered through its hottest spring on record.
Climate change is now affecting every country on every continent.
It's the rate that's a great concern.
And what do you put that rate down to?
Oh, it's human activity.
We have everything we need. Some still doubt that we have the will to act. But I say the will to act is itself a renewable resource.
So, Sean,
hey.
Mr. Marsh, in person, in the flesh.
It's so bizarre. Like, you and I, we talk about this a lot. Like, I feel like I've already met you, but we haven't. And this is our first day in sunny Bayside Dog Park, Dog Beach.
Yep.
Good vibes right now that I needed sorely.
We're introducing this week's episode of Climactic, and we're you know, down at the park here, and we're actually both recording into the same microphone. It's the first time that's happened in months.
Uh-huh. Arms extended out.
That's right. Equidistant. This week's episode of Climactic is actually going to be an episode of your show, Growing Concern, that's on the Climactic Network. And thank you very much for letting me run one of your episodes as this week's episode.
Hey, I'm honored. Anything that I do can be absolutely repurposed for anything climactic. The more we get this stuff out there, the better.
Yeah.
You know, and so hence why, you know, anything I do create for Growing Concern, I'll then share with the collective to then use, like, music that I'm making, those sorts of things, because, you know, we're better off when we are a unified voice. So absolutely, yeah, stoked.
And one of the hardest things, I think, about being a podcaster that a lot of people who maybe just listen to podcasts don't really understand is that, you know, most podcasts you listen to, especially that aren't big productions from big networks, are really solo endeavors. People are working away on stuff in their bedrooms, and it is quite like the only time you might be speaking to anyone else in the whole production is the interview.
Yeah.
And then you might be like kind of sweating bullets.
Right.
You've only had the one chance and you got a guest, and it's hectic, and it's so cool to actually get to talk to someone else before an episode comes out, and then get to repurpose stuff and
big time.
There's second
lots of lessons I've learned from you, particularly is sort of, you know, if you sit with something for so long, you overthink it, and you possibly, and in my case I have, missed certain, you know, opportunities that I could have done a wrap up at the end of the episode, or I could have asked different questions in a different way to listen to a different response. So having, like, you know, the collective in general as a place just to be like, is this shit or is it a hit? Like, help me. It can be quite arduous. But I guess if you do it for the love of it, you don't realize until you've put in, like, the 8th hour on an episode cutting out ums and ahs and, you know, but it's such a cool thing to do.
It really is. I've been a huge fan of Growing Concern since you first described it to me. And I from the first time I heard you speak at a Bayside Climate Action Group panel, and I thought, you know, this guy, he's got a unique take on things, he's got a unique voice on things, and he's not a traditional climate voice. He brings enough of kind of like everyday life to it. You know, this is something that, you know, you started off as just a guy who got into climate. And I think a lot of other media in this space comes at it very much of like, we're freaked out and we've been activists for years now. What else can we do?
Yeah.
How do you kind of describe Growing Concern to people, and what is it now that there's been a few episodes released?
Certainly evolved, but in a way that it just feels quintessentially me. And like you say, I do come at this from a different point of view. My entire sort of vibe on this is that I want to communicate in the most succinct way possible, because, and I've my history is design, marketing, comms, that sort of stuff. So distilling down complex information into simple bite-sized chunks is like my bread and butter. I love it, because if you can help someone learn something that's probably, you know, alienating or easily dismissed because it's just too hard basket, and you actually go, well, no, I get that, and let's do something about it, that's huge. You know, I love that so much.
The name of the show is Growing Concern, and the concern, of course, is the climate crisis.
Yep.
You kind of think the house is on fire a bit, but rather than writing a paragraph, you're trying to fit on a sign saying, excuse me, the building is on fire, and if you wouldn't mind kindly vacating the premises at your earliest convenience. You're creating a show that says fire exit.
Yeah.
And cutting to the chase a lot. The episode in particular that we're, you know, introducing now and that people are about to hear is an interview with a friend of yours, but he's an airline pilot. And I can totally imagine the topic of airlines and what it's like to work in that industry and how it intersects with the climate crisis could have been really dry and could have been very much about emissions in the troposphere, given like, you know, the height at which planes fly, How did you kind of approach this episode in a more human way? Granted that, you know, your guest was a mate.
Totally, yeah. So I'm obviously privy to things that other people wouldn't have. If someone else had decided to get him on a podcast, they probably would have talked about the academia of atmospheric, you know, effects of blah, blah, blah. But I knew that, you know, he'd gone through a fair few challenges this year, as have everybody, right? But for him in particular, like, he became redundant from a job that he dedicated his entire life to. He's now a dad. His wife also works in the same company doing domestic flights. So for them, it's just like completely flipped upside down. I think the way that we have to have better conversations about these things is through a human lens. We actually have to speak to people's struggles. And I know this from my work in, you know, creative, that you talk about stats and pie charts and stuff, it just doesn't connect.
It was a really, really good conversation with Nick, and I'm really excited to be able to share it with the climactic listener who may not have heard Growing Concern before. Where do you recommend people go to get more of the show if they like what they're about to hear?
Yeah, well, climactic.com.au. I've also got a page on my site, but, you know, I think Climactic is the place.
We're really, really happy to have you, Sean, and thank you for letting us share it with our audience today.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
So you're up in the sky, around 38,000 feet. You stare out the window and you see a very familiar view. You've been on this flight countless times before. It's not everyone's typical commute, but it is for you. It's just another day, another dollar. But you're not on your way to work. This is your work. You're not the passenger, you're the pilot. In the last few years, you've been flying the 787 Dreamliner around the globe to places like Melbourne, LA, London, Buenos Aires, Hong Kong, and you've noticed a shift. The world around you is changing, and you're able to see it firsthand from the widest perspective possible. The pilot I'm referring to is Nick Thorne, an old friend of mine. He's dedicated himself over the past decade and a half to becoming a high-ranking Qantas pilot. He's been all over the planet, seen things that most people can only dream of, especially now, and he has a uniquely holistic perspective on our planet that's opened his eyes to the irrefutable, tangible reality of climate change. And once he saw it, he couldn't ignore it. Pilots get a lot of downtime between flights, plenty of time to sit and think, and compelled by the things he'd witnessed, Nick set about searching for local solutions and discovered the Bayside Climate Crisis Action Group. Fast forward a few months, and Nick was addressing the Bayside City Council in a bid to persuade them to call a climate emergency. And they were successful. Nick's career as a pilot was unquestionably concrete, but then COVID-19 hit, and everything we thought we knew about job security went completely out the window. Since then, Nick's become a dad. The future for him and his family feels far less secure than it did before 2020 came along and made a mess of things. So faced with this uncertainty, Nick's resolve kicked in again. He's now studying atmospheric science in the hope he can solve big problems at the intersection of aviation and climate change. It's impressive to say the least. Before we kick into our conversation, here's Nick addressing the Bayside City Council.
Thank you, Mayor. I live locally and work as an international airline pilot for Qantas, flying the 787 Dreamliner. I'm here to discuss my unique perspective of climate change I see in my job and how declaring a climate emergency would be beneficial. The problems I observe with climate change are all over the world are directly related to what we do in the local community. My main office view is the Pacific Ocean. Our oceans absorb 80 to 90% of the heat from global warming and then slowly release it over time, locking us into further warming. As the oceans heat up, they expand and cause sea levels to rise. This threatens the many Pacific Islands territories that I fly over. As I fly to Hawaii, it's here that one of the main global measurements of carbon dioxide is made. They show the alarming rise of carbon dioxide in our atmosphere to the same level it was 3 million years ago. On a recent trip to Alaska, I witnessed the unprecedented amount of fires out of season. Every glacier's visitor centre has before and after shots of the glacier receding, and messages pleading with the visitors to take action on climate change. In Canada, I've seen the devastating effect of the pine beetles on the national parks. The warmer climate has allowed them to spread further north. They burrow into the trees and leave them dead and dry. Recently in San Francisco, they were handing out face masks to the crew upon arrival due to the unprecedented smoke from the fires. En route to South America, we fly over Antarctica, which is double the size of Australia and 98% covered in ice. The rate that this ice is now melting has tripled in the last decade. During trips to the UK and Europe this summer, there are extreme heat waves, flooding of sea barriers, and immigration issues that climate change is beginning to trigger. Even though I witnessed these effects all around the world, they are directly related to me and my community. The way I shop, eat, throw out the rubbish, choose my electricity, choose my car investments, whom I vote for. These local actions that I make, they impact the rising sea of the Pacific Islands, the fires in Alaska, the melting glaciers and warming oceans. Our global emissions need to reverse. We need to remove the greenhouse gases from the atmosphere that we put there to stop our entire ecological environment from changing. Climate change is a global emergency that doesn't just need federal government action, but local solutions. Declaring emergencies is something that I train for at least four times a year. As a pilot, after we identify a problem, one of the first things we do is declare an emergency. The declaration of an emergency changes the communication style of all involved to a more direct one, and the decision-making process becomes more efficient. It's for these exact reasons that our local community would benefit from the declaration of a climate emergency, because the next logical question is what can we now do to solve this emergency? Thank you.
Thank you. There may be some questions. There are none. Thank you, Mr.
All right. Hey, Nick. How's it going, mate? Thanks Good. For joining me.
Good. I don't know if I should call you Marshy or Sean.
Mate, call me whatever you want.
I've only ever called you Marshy, so it has to be that.
People don't even know my first name sometimes.
Nah. You don't have one. It's just Marshy.
You can call me whatever you want. We've known each other for long enough.
We have a long time.
Yeah. When was the first time we met?
Mate, you said it was going to be easy questions. I don't know. More than a decade.
Easily.
Definitely more than a decade.
So we're going to talk about who you are, what you've done, the things you've seen, the challenges of 2020, and what the future looks like. Let's just kick this off with, what are your biggest concerns right now?
In terms of climate change?
Anything.
Anything in life?
Yeah, yeah. 2020 has been a nutcase of a year. And for you, it's been a bit of a roller coaster.
Yeah, 2020 has definitely been a roller coaster. Biggest concerns. Well, for me and my family, I mean, I'm married, my wife, and we have a 3-month-old son. So, you know, the number one concern was making sure he was healthy this year. Mm-hmm. So that was probably my biggest concern. But second to that, my wife and I are both airline pilots. So we've both lost our jobs this year. So we both lost our income of sorts. We had that to deal with. We had, and then not knowing when we're going to have that job back. But we're pilots. It's not just a job. Like, my wife wanted to be a pilot since she was a little kid. And I wanted to be one since I was about 18. So this is we lost the ability to pursue our passion. So and part of our identity is lost for that as well. So they're the major concerns. And then, on top of that, we've got, which I guess part of the reason I'm here is, the concerns we have with climate change. And the concern is that, for me, is that, one, I don't think people just don't understand what's happening. And then two is just, we are not doing anything about it.
I know. Yeah.
That is the major concern. Well, the people in power are not doing anything about it.
Yeah, in fact, they're doing the opposite of doing something about it. A while back, I was thinking about, the future generations of kids and how it's going to affect them. But anyone listening to this right now, we will see the negative effects of climate change in our own lifetimes. So the question I was going to ask you is, you're worried about Jag's future, your son, but you and me, it's our future too.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I do a fair bit of work about trying to prevent climate change. which I guess we'll get to. And one of the reasons is, yes, for my son. So my son has, a lot of people will say that my age too, or with young children. I want to make sure that I leave the planet in a good condition for our children. But it's, you know, in 10 to 20 years time, when I'm in the peak of my career, or life, we will be dealing with the consequences of climate change then. That's how rapidly it's changing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And when was the first time you realized that this was an issue? We talked about this a little while back. You said back in the MySpace days, you had stuff on your profile.
Yeah. So I guess for most of my life I've been interested, as far I was thinking about this when you asked me to come on and chat, and I said, well, actually most of my life I've been interested in climate change. The earliest memory I have is of this is, yeah, back when we had good old MySpace, and Al Gore, I guess he was running for president back then, must have been late 1990s. And, you know, Al Gore had the big documentary that came out. I've forgotten the name.
Inconvenient Truth?
Yeah, Inconvenient Truth. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I had my whole MySpace with Inconvenient Truth. You know, I got the code and you paste that in there and you make it look all matching the Inconvenient Truth logos and color scheme. And I remember taking the pledge, whatever the pledge, the climate pledge at the time, which was, you know, switching off. I remember like telling my parents, switch off the lights when you're not using them. You know, that was a big thing back then, less energy consumption. And so I remember watching that, it hitting me, like emotionally, like a lot of people, and thinking, geez, there's a problem. We've got to do something about this. And because we can do something about this, it's quite clear that global warming is being caused by our behavior. So yeah, I remember taking that climate pledge, and it was a list of things, and I listed them on my MySpace, and I was like, I pledge to do these things. So what was it? I can't remember a whole lot because it was quite long ago. I just distinctly remember realizing, you know, me switching off and on the lights affects the climate.
It's such light bulb, it's such a trip to think that that's what we thought was needed back then.
Yeah, and I know now, it's ridiculous now. It's, I mean, now my lights use less than 1% of my energy bill in this where I live. So lights is it's not really a huge issue because of the technology advances. But yeah, that since back then, that was when I first became interested in global warming, as it was called back then. And then, you know, the term changed.
That was well before even I was aware of how serious this was.
Yes. Yeah. Well, you know, I was aware of it, and then it went away. You know, then I didn't really think about it much for a while until, I guess, the past several years is when it started coming back into my field of view. So I'd always had that interest. And with my job on the international airline pilot, you know, I travel all around the world for work, and then in my downtime, I love to travel. So my wife and I just go on holidays around the world, which we can't do at the moment, and we're missing very much. But we love to travel when we can, and it's a goal for us. We plan to do that at least once a year. And in this travel that I've done, it was the past few years that I just noticed that climate change was just impacting everywhere we went. You know, the main one for me that really set me back off now in terms of deciding to make a large part of my life taking action against climate change was we went on a cruise in Alaska. Now, it sounds like old people go on cruises in Alaska and you've got to be, you know, rich and pompous. But remember, I work in the airline industry and we get great discounts on cruises. So we went on this cruise in Alaska it left Vancouver and it went up into what they call the Inside Passage of Alaska. And it was on that cruise that there was an environmentalist that gave presentations each day. And so I went along to those presentations, just being interested in learning and learning about what we were seeing, the spectacular and amazing views that we had. And this environmentalist, over the course of 7 days, gave a lecture every day. And they're really interesting. The first one started off about the natural wildlife and the habitats and how the mountains are formed and what's the difference between a porpoise and a dolphin and all the amazing things that we see up there and how to spot the different animals. And then he even went into things about, you know, the history of our environment and the history of our climate. And he got a lot of people to really buy into what he was saying, especially on this cruise when you had a lot of Americans. It was still a lot of Australians too, but it was skewed to more older generation, baby boomers, retired people, and not generalizing, but you can sort of tell a lot of people had the views that, you know, climate change isn't real. You know, this view that is somewhat popular. And they really bought into, this guy's name is Milos Radakovic. I can't say his last name properly. But there, Milos got these people to buy in, and I really enjoyed his presentation. And then on the last day, he gave a presentation about climate change, and he just dropped the bombshell of climate change on all these people that had already thought, hey, I like this guy. You know, I believe what he says. I trust what he says. And he just showed very simply and quite quickly and efficiently that we are causing climate change by using fossil fuels and changing the amounts of carbon dioxide and other materials in the atmosphere. And that is causing the planet to warm. And the main thing was, he just, for me, that hit me, he just said, well, we're past the tipping point. You can stop all emissions right now. Tomorrow we could go to net zero emissions, carbon neutral, everything. And it's still going to get worse. We are locked in to warming and changing. We are past the tipping point, you know? So you can all debate this whatever you want, but this problem is happening and is already happened. And now we have to learn to live with this new climate that we're creating. The asterisk on that, I guess, is carbon sequestration. So removing the gases that we put there in the atmosphere will then slowly reverse the changes that we made. So I am positive in terms of, we don't just have to get to carbon neutral, we have to get to removing the carbon from the atmosphere.
Yeah,
so
it's when, you know, you have conversations with people about sustainability. Sustainability is just essentially like, you know, keeping things in an even keel. We have to go carbon negative and we have to do it quickly. It's interesting that you say that people bought in personally to Milos. And I'm fascinated by this, where facts and figures, the more you push at someone and say, no, but 20% this and 1.5 degrees, and people seem to shy away from stats and stuff, but they do buy into people's personalities.
Yeah, well, this is what was amazing about this. This is what sticks in my mind, this guy's presentation, because we had hundreds of people there, and I saw them. You know, I'm condensing the story, but, you know, I saw them watch Milos over the course of the week. And you know, we chat to these people when we'd meet them at dinner. That's how the cruises are set up. You go and meet people. And it is really interesting. I really love meeting people on these cruises. There's some fascinating people there. And, you know, we meet to them and talk to them, and you'd understand their views about climate change. You know, I'd naturally talk about it sometimes. And they, you know, they were of the belief that it just wasn't happening or wasn't caused by us, by humans. And it was amazing to watch people's views change at the final day when Milos gave that presentation. And that was what I believe is, and I spoke to Milos about this afterwards, you know, he got the people to believe in him and say, I like this guy and trust this guy. So then when he presented the facts of climate change, they couldn't say, I don't believe him anymore, because they've already gone and told everybody about on the cruise that, hey, instead of going to yoga class, did you know I've been going to the educational classes on the environment or on, you know, the wildlife in Alaska. So they love to talk about how Milos is an expert and now he's made me an expert. So they couldn't all of a sudden say, you know what, he's a crazy dude and what he's saying is wrong. And he's, you know, he's just some, you know, left-wing guy.
Like they had egg on their face.
Yeah, so they couldn't go against their own, you know, beliefs in that sense. So they just had to partly accept what he was saying. And that was the first time I really saw in a short amount of time people with such, you know, they've got views that are already set in stone against climate change and happening, actually change their mind and go, okay, maybe it is. This is a problem. What can we do about it? And, you know, he had questions in the audience afterwards, people putting their hands up saying, hang on, you know, all right, I get what you're saying, but I thought, you know, Trump was good for the environment. You know, it was amazing. People would, it was just like he'd open their minds and they were like, well, hang on, I thought this actually wasn't a problem. You know, rather than just denying it and saying, oh, I'm leaving, this is crazy. They actually were then ready to partly change their mind on.
So it piqued their curiosity in some way, at least.
Yes. Well, I mean, there was a line of people to talk to him afterwards.
Oh, right. Okay.
Because you know, that question for me was when someone put their hand up and they just said, you know, I thought Trump was solving this for us. And, you know, I thought Trump was right, basically, that this wasn't a problem, but you're telling me it is and I believe you. So why was I lied to by Trump, or why is my opinion wrong? Which is pretty amazing for people to come out and stand up and say, you know what, I think I'm wrong, or the people I used to believe were wrong. Why is that? And that for me two things. One, it just was really interesting to see people's opinions change. And then secondly, that was a point that afterwards, after that trip, after that holiday, there was many other examples I've mentioned in that speech that I've seen on holidays. But that particular one, when he said we're past the tipping point and showed why, and I just thought, geez, I didn't know we were past the tipping point. I thought we had heaps of time to solve this.
It's pretty bleak, yeah.
Yeah, and it was just, I thought, I've got to do some more about this. I have to do more. And after that, I took a lot of action. I joined the board of my local climate change action group, and now I've, you know, gone into actually studying a master's of atmospheric science to effectively become a climate scientist in my spare time, which I have a lot of because I'm not flying at the moment.
So that
really set me off that particular moment.
I want to come back to the climate scientist sort of pathway that you're on, but with Milos's approach and the way he was able to engage people, what have you taken from that? Has it changed the way you approach people when you discuss these things?
Yeah, definitely. If you're going to talk to somebody about climate change, a lot of people will just get angry if they come across someone they don't believe. I see this on a lot of, even a lot of social media posts by political parties that I might mostly agree with. If you don't understand climate change, you're an idiot type of approach, which is just, it's not going to work. It's not going to, you know, you have to be kind and respectful to the people that you talk to if you're going to change their mind. They have to like you first before they will even consider changing their mind to your point of view, no matter what you're talking to them about. So I think, first of all, coming from a place of respect, understanding why somebody might have the belief that it's clearly false, that, you know, climate change is a hoax, you know, for example. And there's a lot of people in society that have that belief. So, you know, why do they have that? And you have to come from a point of, well, this might be an opportunity to try and educate them. Well, why aren't they educated in that way? Rather than saying they're stupid for not being educated, often there's more behind it in terms of they're not stupid. They just, you know, why did they come to that point of view? And if they can like you and respect you, then you have a chance to then change their mind. And I think we have to do that because we have too many people that don't understand climate change and have these beliefs that are false, that are causing harm to our environment. I think a lot of us need to change our tact in terms of trying to change other people's minds.
Yeah, it is interesting. Climate change, just the science in general, you can on the surface say it's very clear, but it's also extremely complex. There are still some people that don't understand that there's a difference between weather and climate, you know, averaging. So like the whole global warming conversation around, oh, but it was cold this winter, so that's rubbish, or it's even colder in this part of the world now. If you think about it, if you come across something that's really uncomfortable and something that's actually quite complex, it's easier if you get the narrative of it's a hoax. You're like, you know what? That's easier. I'm going
to
go with
that.
Because it's a frightening... The issue is terrifying.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think being nice to people and gaining their trust is what we've seen done very effectively by people who are pro-fossil fuels, for example.
Yeah, yeah. It's well thought out.
Extremely well thought out.
Yes.
They know exactly what they're doing. And I'll draw the line at being nice to them.
Well, yeah, I know. And then I get angry at this stuff too, but... It's just like anger is not gonna. It's not gonna solve this issue.
Yeah.
You know, there is a lot of anger, and you got to use it. We saw with the climate protests. I was in San Francisco for those global, the one that basically Greta Thunberg started.
Mm.
And I was in San Francisco, and it was amazing the amount of people there. And you know, there's a lot of anger in that crowd, and you got to use it, but you can't use the anger on the people that you're trying to change. Their mind is just not going to work.
Yeah, it's anger is one of those emotions that it's understandable, but it also is very unruly and can just be, it can lash out in all different directions. And typically it isn't as effective as it could be. Speaking of effective, you were part of getting Bayside City Council to declare an emergency. Can you tell me all about that?
Yeah, climate emergency. Yeah. So after that cruise, that was when I actually went up to Milos and spoke to a few people. I said, what can I do here that's more, you know, I'm an airline pilot. what can I actually do? And someone said, just take action at a local level. Why aren't you doing that already? And I thought, yeah, Nick, why aren't I doing that? And as soon as I got back from that holiday, I just looked up local climate change action groups, and I found one called BCAG, is the acronym BCCAG, Bayside Climate Crisis Action Group, that we now call ourselves. And long story short, I joined the board, and with that group, I really like that group because they know the local politics really well. They understand the science, and they know what needs to be done, and they're effective. So with that, we got a bunch of people to come together. We actually got the Bayside Council to declare a climate emergency after putting, you know, a lot of work around this, and then getting multiple people to make certain speeches at the council meeting. And yeah, the council said, yes, there is a climate emergency, as many other councils have done this. And but it was the work of this group that then got that council to do that. And then the council, the local level, then takes out to the state and federal level, and they said, we call on the federal government to do more to reduce emissions. So to me, that is taking action rather than sharing something on Facebook or going to a protest, which are important. I feel like, you know, we worked on something, we actually got a political message across that by law has to be listened to. So, you know, we effected some sort of change there. And then on a state, a local level, we're now in the process of actioning out this climate emergency action plan, which will protect trees or, you know, make decisions for renewable energy, et cetera. And so I think it's one of the best things you can do is to take action on a local level, because that's how politics in Australia works. You know, we impact our local level, that then goes to the state level, that then goes to the federal level. And the actions that we do with BCAG is that, yeah, we've got the council to declare a climate emergency. The adjacent council then did it shortly there afterwards. And then now they are, you know, we're holding them accountable to actioning this plan.
Yeah. It's like you said, you did it. So what are you doing now?
Yeah. And they have got a plan. You know, we don't think it's good enough, but they have got a plan now after that is, you know, taking action on climate change directly. Mm-hmm. You know, buildings are being changed. Electricity is being changed. You know, trees are being more protected. The construction materials are being reconsidered. So things, that to me is making change. If everybody did that at their local level, we would have mass change.
Yeah. I was in the room when you had your speech, and it was quite the emotional event, really, because at the end of it, the entire room just erupted in applause as they said, we unanimously declare a climate emergency. And I was I didn't expect this was, like, it just hit me. I was like,
we packed out the council chambers with everybody that wanted this to happen. Yeah. So when they voted for the climate emergency, and this is a fairly conservative council, when they voted and said this is a climate emergency, it was a really big, it was a crescendo of all of the work that that we've done in that organization. And there's some people in that organization that dedicate their lives to it. You know, I do it in my spare time, but there's a lot of people in there that are pretty amazing.
Like who?
Oh, the president, David Rothfield. You know, he's a retired guy, but he effectively works full time on this, and he leads this action group to take action at local, state, and federal levels. You know, he lobbies the federal government, lobbies the state government. He is doing some amazing work in actually, you know, getting political change in terms of action on climate change.
So he's directing his energies in the most efficient ways, is it?
I think so. I think it's an efficient way to do it. I mean, there's other ways to do it. You could start a company that is, you know, has renewable energy. There's definitely other ways to do it, but you know, in terms of my profession is an airline pilot, and in my spare time, I can impact positively climate change by volunteering and helping with this local group that takes action. There's definitely things that are positive. You know, don't eat a lot of red meat, etc. Change the way you throw out your rubbish. All very important. But for me, I wanted to take a bit more action than just do the small things that I think everybody should do. A lot of my generation too, we happen to donate money, but we also want to donate our time. You know, I wanted to work on something that I would be proud of and say, you know, I worked on this, you know, we made stuff happen.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And we also want to see tangible outcomes from that energy and that money and It's
We got to do something about it. We got to do something about this. We got to fight, you know, for our lives for this, because when you understand the problem, it is scary, man.
It is scary. I've had a couple of minor freakouts the last couple of days. Just doing this podcast in general, I've come across information and had conversations where it's just sort of been a constant slap in the face. The sting doesn't seem to go away.
Yeah.
But I don't want that anxiety to just shut me down. I got to keep going.
You have to keep going. But it's just when you understand, we say that it looks like the climate is going to warm by about 2 degrees. You know, we've probably already locked that in with the amount of heat that we have in our oceans now already that are slowly being released. And then you go 2 degrees, okay. But then when you understand what 2 degrees increase to our overall climate does, that is scary. You know, go look that up. And it impacts everything. It impacts everything in the way everybody lives their life. It's going to impact my job as a pilot, that we're flying through increased turbulence. We've got issues of the landing and smoke we had in Australia this year. We couldn't land with the smoke. We didn't have the technology set up for that.
And also there's a headwind that's changed at Melbourne Airport.
Yeah, the winds are changing directions at the airports. The jet streams around the world are moving. You know, that's going to have impacts on other climates, smaller climates around the planet as well.
Yeah, migratory patterns of birds.
Yeah, that's what I mean. It's everything. You know, you pick a profession we can pretty quickly come up with a way it's going to affect you.
We went to an event where some guy, I forget his name, was talking about climate change in sport and at 2 degrees of warming, you just won't see people playing sport outside in summer.
Yeah.
Because it'll just be too hot.
At times, correct. Yeah. Yeah.
So if you're listening and you're into sport and you want to keep watching it, then maybe take this seriously.
Yeah. If you're listening, you're probably already taking it seriously.
That's probably true. Yeah. So with this atmospheric science degree that you're we discussed this, it's a begrudging change of pace and direction for you. How does it feel, and are you excited about the future, and what are your plans?
Oh, yeah. So there's a lot in that. So let me unpack it. Well, you know, start of the year, my wife and I, she was pregnant. We're on holidays in Europe, and we're living our dream. You know, we both dreamt of being pilots. I'm international. She's domestic at the moment. She's a pilot as well. And so we said to each other that we are just living our dream at the moment. You know, everything is going well for us. And we planned it and worked hard for that. And then, you know, the pandemic. We were actually in Italy when the pandemic began. We were in Venice. We were driving out of Venice to the lakes in Italy when it broke out in that region. And as we moved down in Italy further south, the pandemic wasn't a pandemic then. It was just COVID-19 was following us. And it was a great experience to see it happening there. Terrible experience of what was happening to the people of Italy. We ended up, leaving the holiday early and just coming home because the whole global situation was changing back then very rapidly. And when we came out to Australia, it was quite amazing. You know, we had a friend's wedding that we went to a couple of weeks after coming back. And at the wedding, everyone's together and kissing and hugging and getting drunk and spitting on each other when they talk. And we had no idea, and we just said to each other, because we'd been in Italy, and Italy was sort of where, you know, we was like 2 or 3 months in the future compared to everyone else, and we said, you have no idea what's coming. You know, they're going to lock things down, you're going to be wearing masks, it's a you know, this is, you got to get serious about this disease at the moment. And it was amazing watching Australia follow the path that we just experienced in Italy and slowly lock down. You know, I'm sitting in my house right now, and I've effectively been under house arrest here since March.
Yeah, I know you well enough that you're hating it, aren't you?
Well, my playground for me used to be the world. I used to travel the world now, and my life would happen in different places around the world. Now, my entire life takes place in the living room. And that's definitely getting to me, like I think everybody else. And having a baby in a pandemic was another experience for, I guess, another entire podcast episode. So the pandemic happened. We got stood down from our dream jobs. Even domestic flying we thought would return, which hasn't yet. And, you know, sitting there left with the with the prospect of possibly not returning to a job. We don't know what's going to happen. At the moment, we still have our jobs in the future, which we're very, very grateful for. We have friends that have lost their entire careers, been made redundant. And I just don't know what's going to happen in the future. You know, both of us are reliant on an income from being pilots. So I thought, I've got to take some sort of control here, take action. And I want to try and do something with my, you know, I have a passion for flying. I love flying. And I love the airline that I work for, and I love my job. But, you know, I'm also passionate about climate change. So I thought, is there something I can do to combine those things? Because I think I'm going to have a flying job, but I don't know. I don't know. In 2 years' time, I may not. So can I do something in this time that sort of satisfies both of those requirements, you know? I also used to have I guess I got a few interests. I used to have a financial education business, online business. I used to run that, and I founded it, ran it, and sold it a few years ago. So I thought maybe I can get back into that. But I thought, you know, I think and I hope that I will have a pilot job again, which is what I really want to do. So I don't want to go down the financial education path that I've done before. So I thought, you know, hell, why not just get requalified a little bit and become effectively a climate scientist, but specializing in aviation? You know, aviation is changing the climate with emissions, but climate change is impacting aviation and some of the things we spoke about. So, yeah, long story short, I applied to do a master's of science or master's of atmospheric science. And you have to pick a research project because I've already have a bachelor's degree, so I could do a master's, and my research project is going to be something about the impacts of climate change on aviation. It'll be something more specific when we get, as we're working on it right now, and trying to combine industry and academic as well.
Does something like that exist?
Yeah, like there's a lot of work has already been done in this area. You know, as we mentioned, that we know that jet streams are changing because of climate change, because people have done research on them. We know that temperatures in certain airports are going to increase, and therefore tires are going to melt. Well, the pavement is going to melt. You can't land heavy aircraft on them. So there's areas that we understand. It's just which area do we want to have a bit of a better understanding? What can I contribute to that area? And something specifically for my, hopefully something more specific for, you know, where I operate mostly, which is in Australia, because we have a lot of research over the Atlantic in terms of the North Atlantic jet streams and things like that. Because that's where most of the traffic is, but there's not much work done on the Pacific, which is mostly where I fly between Americas and Australia. So I'll probably pick something around that. So yeah, I went and I got accepted, and I've been studying now part-time a master's of atmospheric science. So on my way to becoming a climate scientist. And the way I see it is that when I finish that, you know, when I return to flying, which I really hope I do, I can use it in my flying. And do something more than just a pilot, and hopefully get airlines around the world to take more action and to reduce their emissions, which is possible. And then also, you know, if my flying career doesn't return because no one knows what's happening with this pandemic, then I can just purely go and work as a climate scientist somewhere and at least have work that is meaningful and that I'm passionate about.
I think the sad irony of all that is that there will be work for you in climate science in the future.
Yes. Yeah. 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 Yeah, the challenge I've had with this is the thing that I still come up against is that part of me is like, all right, we just know there's a problem. Do I want to actually still become a climate scientist, or should I just go start a company or work on something that actually is just part of the solution? But I still think it's really important.
I think this is absolutely part of the solution. Yeah. I think the intersection of what you have done, so you deeply understand that, to then a problem that you also deeply understand. And then you're sitting yourself right in the middle and saying, okay, cool, I'm going to use my understanding, and I'm just going to try and fix what I can at the best part.
Yeah, well, I've been flying for airline for about 10 years and previous flying experience. So I wanted to use that. I wanted to be able to say, well, my specialist is in aviation. I want to try and help aviation become better at, you know, stopping climate change and then dealing with it. As I said, you know, it's going to happen. It's happening. I think the logical thing is once people understand climate change, they want to take action against it.
Yeah.
That generally follows.
Yeah. And I mean, that's the whole reason I'm doing this is that, you know, we talk about it, we share ideas, and most importantly, like, you know, tangible solutions. And your story is one of those moments where you've had to pivot your life and you've chosen something that's incredibly impressive and really is a solid solution to an issue that you know pretty well. What about, I mean, what would you say to someone else that's in a similar situation to you? Because clearly most people are. And in terms of like job security, like no one ever thought that a pilot would, like the entire workforce of pilots around the world would be stood down.
No one wants to feel sorry for pilots either. They all think that we're super rich and, you know, that no one's like, you're a pilot, you're fine. What are you talking about?
Do you get lumped in with doctors sometimes?
Oh, yeah, I guess. Yeah. Doctors probably work a bit harder than us, but.
Yes, they would definitely put more. Well, I mean, you do have a bit of downtime, but when you're on, I guess.
Yeah, anyway. you got to be on any time, you know, 2 a.m.
Yeah. But like local solutions and suggestions for anyone listening to this episode, any nuggets of wisdom you'd like to share?
Oh, what is in terms of climate change and taking action, you're saying?
Or yeah, I mean, because you've been a part of local stuff. You had that drive. You sought out BCAG, you found
them. Well, yeah. Look, one of the best things I think is mainly two things. Is what sort of the message I guess I've been trying to get across is, you know, one, get educated on it. It's not hard to get educated on it. There's some fantastic websites out there. There's, you know, Skeptical Science is one of them, and you can even do small little qualification courses on there. You know, just get educated from a reputable source. And then secondly, I just look to take action at a local level. There are. I'm on the board of this, of BCAG, this, you know, the local action group. And there are hundreds of these groups. We have to form an organization to group of them all. We call it BCAN. There's so many acronyms. It's like flying acronyms, but, you know, it's there's a Bayside Emergency Climate Action Network. And so we have a network of all these other groups. And, you know, every council has some of these groups. Or one of these groups. Some of them may be more active than others. And it doesn't matter if you don't live in that exact council, just choose the one next closest to you. But I would say, look at where you can take action on a local level. And I think that's really effective. It's generally really easy. These organizations will already have things and ways you can do it. So you don't even have to be expert in this area. You know, I'm certainly not an expert in a lot of the other areas that people on the board are really good with. They understand the local politics, and they'll say, look for your local organization and join that organization and then bring the skills that you have across. So with my organization, I'm on the board there, but I more use my skills in terms of the understanding I have on building with climate change. So they can come to me as a part of a fact check or something, but more so, you know, I've got skills just being younger than most of the other people on the board in terms of previously running a business, in terms of advertising and marketing and building websites and growing lists and getting the message out there. So I'm helping them mostly with growing the amount of people that are on, you know, their list, because they already have a really small active group of people that, you know, yeah, take action, like declare climate emergencies at the council. I mean, this is pretty amazing, the stuff that they've already done. And their meetings draw a lot of people already, and they only have a small people on their list. In our local council, there's 105,000 people. We've got like less than 1% of that on our list. And I want to take that to, you know, around 5%. I want to help them grow the people on their list. And then that will naturally get more people taking action, and you'll just get the council listening. If you've got more people, you've got more power, and the council and the local MPs will listen and take action on it.
So wrapping up, I think you sit really well in the BCAG group in terms of like your understanding of technology in general, and also like the digital world and social media. So if anyone's listening and you have a similar sort of grasp of, you know, things that potentially the older generations may not have, then you'll fit in perfect like a jigsaw puzzle. A lot of the older generations have grown up understanding grassroots movements, protesting, you know, speaking to elected representatives. And clearly what you've done, Nick, is you've understood that these are my skill sets. My values are very good at public speaking as well. And so they've obviously pulled you in and said, we need this guy. This is great. What a jackpot. So more people getting involved in a similar way. And like you say, people power.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that you should just definitely approach your local organization and see what you can do. Ask where they need help or tell them where you're going to help. They're not going to turn you away. And I just think it's a fantastic, I've been really satisfied and really proud of the work that I can do with just on a local level. And I'm sort of surprised or annoyed I didn't think of it earlier.
Well, I mean, I sometimes feel that way myself about certain things, but here we are, we're doing it. We're getting shit done. Let's keep going, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think we have to start taking big action, and we have to start getting change to happen. Otherwise, we're already in a world of trouble soon.
Yeah, we're cooked.
So we've just got to start making massive change. Mm-hmm. You know. Yeah, like I said, it's not even carbon neutral. We have to reverse it, mm-hmm. you know. We're not even anywhere near that in terms of a large society understanding that's what needs to happen.
Yeah, yeah.
So we have so far to go, which I guess is, I don't want to end on a negative note, but we have to understand how far we have to go so we can all start working together and making change and speeding up how quick we can get there. The inspiring thing for me is seeing a lot of some of these wealthy individuals that are really making a difference or changing, getting the message out there. So there is definitely a lot of inspiration out there. There are a lot of people making change, and just trying to align yourself or find some of these people that are making that change and get on board with them.
Thank you for joining us. You've been listening to Climactic, the flagship podcast of the Climactic Collective, a podcast network dedicated to lifting the voices of the climate community. You can find out more about the people of the Climactic Collective and all the shows on the network at climactic.com.au. Thank you for listening, and until next time, keep up the great work and take care of each other in these climactic times.
The Climactic Collective.
This show is produced by Hear Media, a boutique audio agency in Narm, Melbourne. To learn more and get in touch, head to hearmedia.studio. That's HERE media.studio.